This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, November 9th. Today, I'm really looking forward to today's program because my guest is going to be Dr. Michael Stevens. Dr. Stevens is a PhD in clinical psychology, and his area of interest has been neuropsychiatry and ADHD. So attention deficit hyperactive disorder. We hear that all the time. And, you know, we always associate it with children, but more and more we're starting to see people diagnosed in adulthood. And I really want to find out more about that and how people just finding this diagnosis and getting treatment can actually, it really can change their lives. Also, a lot of people who are presenting with some cognitive difficulties when they seek care are finding out that throughout their lives they've had ADHD and they were not developing a dementia or other cognitive type of impairment. So I really want to clear up some of the confusion, and he is the expert in this field. He is a professor of psychiatry. He's director of the Olin Neuropsychiatry Research Center at Hartford Healthcare. So it's going to be great to chat with him. He's going to be calling in at 11:15. This past week, we had an election, and there is a lot going on. I think a lot of what people are saying is going to change is pertaining to health. And I think that that's where our program is going to play a role, right? Now, there's a lot of discussion about interactions with physicians and freedom to choose. But the key thing is there a scientific basis for me and you as individuals to change our behavior, whatever is proposed? Again, we need to never turn our backs on the idea of science. So there's a lot of talk about new choices, and again, to help us work through those choices, we really need to use science. So we will continue as things come up in the world and whatever changes might be made to the healthcare system, for better or worse, we will be discussing them here. November 9th, 1606, Dr. Hermann Conring was born. He's an interesting fellow in the sense that he was a physician in Germany, and he did a lot of early work and discussion on blood circulation, later went on to become a politician. So he did a lot of early work back in 1606 in a very different world at that time, and especially in Germany, with Lutheranism and things such as that going on. So an interesting history there. And we recognize his work in science and his contributions to science. A few things that have come up in the last week. I want to get some quick topics in. First thing is the FDA is telling us do not throw away expired COVID tests. So here's what's happening. We've accumulated a lot of these COVID tests, and they have expiration dates on them. But these expiration dates change. What is happening is a company can now apply and demonstrate to the FDA that the shelf life is actually longer than what was expected when it was made. So like many things related to COVID, we're learning as we go along. So before you throw those things out, go to fda.gov and look at the brand and the type and see if it really did expire, because they certainly come in handy as we developed flu-like symptoms of this winter, and we want to be sure we don't have COVID. So again, very important, don't be throwing those out right away. Also, one of the things that has come up and we've talked about on this program is the use of AirPods. Now, AirPods, for those of you not familiar, are an Apple product that you put in your ears, and they're headphones. The AirPods are now have a change in their software so that they could be used as hearing aids. So if you're in an area, say you're listening, you're on a plane or something, and you want to hear something more rather than less, you can use that feature on them. And it's important because about 1 in 8 Americans over the age of 12 have some form of hearing loss in both ears. And, you know, a lot of people won't use hearing aids, obviously because of cost. A lot of times it's poor fit. But so many people use AirPods now to listen to music, listen to podcasts, hey, to listen to this program. Of those people, about 15% of Americans are experiencing hearing loss, and those people are mostly over the age of 60. So now with the rule change, you could even buy over-the-counter hearing aids for about $400 or $500. But you have to be careful with what you're buying. A lot of them are really just kind of cheap amplifiers. But the AirPods sell for about $249 on the Apple website. And I think they're going to be very effective in terms of working with hearing and a multiple function. So if you own a pair, go to the Apple website. It'll tell you how to download that firmware. I actually did it to my phone this morning, and it didn't take very long at all. So, and also there's a new feature where you can administer a hearing test for yourself to test your own hearing to see if you need them. So again, that's all built in. It's not a special app of any type. Many of our listeners participate in weight training, right? You go to the gym and you kind of hook up with a personal trainer. And, you know, there's a lot of theories on weight training. You know, the old no pain, no gain idea goes a long way. But some of this thought of failure training, so the idea of lifting weights until you can't do any more, and that's how most of us were trained to use weights, and it works for somebody who really wants to build up muscle mass. If you want to really develop muscle and become really built, you want to train to failure, but you don't have to, and there's really a difference between training for health and training for elite performance as an athlete. So those of us who are more interested in training for health really should just work with about 5 or 10 repetitions, and you don't have to necessarily get to failure. Because when you get to that training to failure phase, first of all, when you tire your muscles out that much, you're going to get tired, right? They're going to get fatigued. You're going to feel it the next day. One of the things I see in a lot of my patients are, you know, a lot of people caught on to this various cross training and suddenly thought they went to the fountain of youth and they could do all these exercises and end up hurting themselves, tearing muscles, injuring their joints. So again, you have to use some judgment when you're using weights, and you still can get a good benefit towards your health overall. One of the things you also want to avoid is rhabdomyolysis, where muscle breaks down and it can lead to impairment of kidney function. So you really want to be sure when you're doing this weight training and going to the gym, it's not a question of trying to keep up with everybody else. Again, just be mindful as you move through your exercise routine. You know, we've said a lot and we've heard a lot about Ozempic, right? Ozempic being the weight loss drug that people are using, originally designed for diabetes and people with diabetes, and we found that it helps people lose weight. But there's new data showing that it also helps, first of all, with people who are addicted to opioids in terms of avoiding drug overdose. And something I was interested in, there's a trial ongoing regarding patients who are alcoholic, and it diminishes a person's desire for alcohol. So just as it diminishes your desire for food and for overeating, it will also work from the standpoint of alcoholism. So that study has been ongoing as well, and we'll keep an eye on that. So very interesting to find out more and more about Ozempic and that whole classification of drugs. We're going to take a short break, then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Michael Stevens. If you wish to reach out to me, you can get to me at info@alessimd.com. We're going to be talking today about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactive disorder, both in children and in adults. So if you have questions pertaining to that, I'm happy to take them right now. With that, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome my guest today, Dr. Michael Stevens. Dr. Stevens is a PhD in clinical psychology, and he is director of the Olin Neuropsychiatry Research Center at Hartford Healthcare. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about your background. What have you developed and what have you gone through in terms of your background in clinical neuropsychology?
Well, like most of the people who were trained the way that I was in graduate school, you end up going through a PhD program. I actually graduated from the University of Connecticut out in Storrs and underwent the standard training that a clinical psychologist gets. That includes a year of an internship where I did mine down at the West Haven VA Medical Center. And then you go through postdoctoral training while you wait to study and pass licensing tests to practice professionally in the field. My own training was a little bit different than most psychologists because instead of just being trained to do psychotherapy or assessments that are standard for the field, I decided to specialize very early on in the branch of neuropsychology. Some people are familiar with that, a lot of people aren't, but this is a specialty of clinical psychology where you use in-depth cognitive testing of intelligence, attention, memory, language, executive and attention functions, and usually ends up doing evaluations that end up with these long 5, 10, 20-page reports making recommendations about people's capacity and linking those problems that you find to different types of head injuries or neurological conditions or psychological conditions.
Mike, do you find more people getting those tests now than in the past for a variety of reasons?
Yeah, I think the field has changed quite a bit over the past several decades. When I got trained as a neuropsychologist, I think we were, I don't know, maybe in the second generation of the field being part of medical practice as a standard. My own graduate mentor, Dr. Deborah Fine at the UConn Storrs program, was trained by some of the pioneers in the field. But since then, it's become kind of commonplace. I mean, I still have close contact with a lot of my colleagues who are practicing full time, and their wait lists are a year long sometimes. They're desperate to hire newly trained neuropsychologists because the information that's provided can be so helpful for particularly for students, for educational planning, for helping to identify whether there's something going on that might be more neurobiological in nature rather than something that should be addressed with psychotherapy. The field has grown and become much more useful as the decades have gone by.
Can you explain a little bit, and I think people sometimes confuse this a little bit, and that is when you talk about neuropsychological testing, you're talking about sometimes it's a full day of testing, but there are a lot of computerized tests out there, and I keep seeing them come across my desk that are done by paraprofessionals. Can you explain the difference in what you do and these other kind of computerized quick exams?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A question like that makes me start to feel my age and how long I've been in the field. When I was trained, things were really just taking off with computerized testing. And there were a lot of purists out there that they were, oh, no, we can't do anything by computer. It's all got to be one-on-one. You can't have valid tests. But we've learned over time that there are many things that are assessed cognitively can be facilitated and sometimes even improved on by using computerized versions of tests. Those tests just need to be developed and validated in the same careful, meticulous way that the tests that started the field out. Where it becomes problematic is that any person out there with programming skills, particularly with access to the internet, sometimes thinks that they can just whip up a test. And that's not really the way it works. The tests that are used in clinical practice today usually undergo years, if not decades, of development and refinement. One of the key things about neuropsychological testing is that those tests are always the scores are compared to large population norms. If you want to know if someone has an average memory ability, you have to be able to compare that person's performance to memory ability in thousands of other people. And not just generally, but you want to know if a memory for a 55-year-old person is normal for other people who are 55 years old. So it takes a lot of effort, and there's only a few leading test companies that develop these things, and it has to be done with a lot of rigor. However, those tests have become commonly used in clinical reports. And what you see these days is a mixture. Usually the batteries are about 4 or 5 hours long, thanks to changes in insurance reimbursements. Sure. But and they tend to focus on more specialty things. But they're a mix of those in-person back-and-forth tests that I was trained on primarily decades ago, as well as these newer tests developed over the past 20 years that are equally as informative that are computer-based.
We have about a minute before we have to stop for a break, but can you briefly tell our guests what the Olden Neuropsychiatry Research Center is?
Oh, yeah, with pride. The Olin Center was formed over 20 years ago, in large part due to philanthropic donations to the Institute of Living, which is one of the main psychiatric hospital campuses as part of the Hartford Healthcare Network. And from its very beginning, its mission was to do cutting-edge neuroscience research in ways that would help us better understand the causes of major psychiatric disorders and to use that information to leverage towards developing new treatments. It has consistently been, in its 20 years of operation, a 40 to 50 person strong academic research center of excellence plopped right down in the middle of Hartford, Connecticut, where my colleagues and I have worked to understand, brain disorders in all sorts of psychiatric diagnoses ranging across the field with great success. We've been doing a lot of NIH-funded research and made some truly impressive, commendable gains in our understanding of all sorts of things, ADHD, schizophrenia, bipolar illness, head injury, PTSD, anxiety disorders, you name it.
It's unbelievable, and it's great to have that available right here in Hartford. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to continue our discussion with Dr. Stevens. We're going to be talking about ADHD versus ADD. We're going to talk about the diagnosis of it in adults as well. If you have questions for me, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com if you have any questions for Dr. Stevens. And we'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds, and my guest today is Dr. Michael Stevens. And we're chatting about neuropsychology and specifically ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactive Disorder. Mike, what is it?
Well, I think the most important thing to say is that there's a difference in terminology. You know, a lot of people, as you did before the break, mentioned, let's talk about ADHD versus ADD.
Correct.
I think the easiest way to understand this is that there's a long history of people who have recognized ADHD as a disorder. It actually stretches back over 100 years. But as doctors were trying to figure out what really the disorder was all about, Throughout the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, the disorder went through a couple of name changes. People typically think in just the general population that ADHD and ADD are different things because they've been presented with people who are hyperactive and have impulsive behavior or people who just have that distractible inattentiveness. But experts recognize it all as one disorder. And all of our research to take a look at what causes it and how to treat it as a unitary thing. But people understand it easier if they slap a different label on it. And that's where we get ADHD versus ADD. But at the end of the day, we're talking about a disorder that generally arises in childhood. It's usually recognized before kids hit middle school, but not always. And it consists of people who display symptoms that are either hyperactive behavior, impulsive behavior, or inattentive, disorganized behavior in some combination that are severe enough to actually cause problems with their functioning, either problems in school, being able to live up to their potential and get the grades they want, or even just social problems, kids who have difficulty making friends or sustaining friendships. And these things can persist throughout the lifespan through adulthood and into older ages, sometimes a little bit lesser in intensity, but still quite impairing for these individuals.
Mike, I guess one of the things that always comes up is, you know, how do you really differentiate and recognize what is, for lack of a better term, different or abnormal versus kind of normal behavior for a preteen or a young child in terms of personality and things such as that. You know, and I think we get into the idea also of people being diagnosed, either overdiagnosed, underdiagnosed. So how do teachers, it's usually teachers who bring it to the attention of parents, but often I would think parents, but how does the process develop? How does somebody say, hey, I think this child has ADHD?
Oh, you know, that's a conversation that might take even much longer than the show has just to cover this one topic. I think the easiest take-home message is that it is a process to get a proper diagnosis of ADHD. One of the most common questions I get from parents or people in the community is, hey, who can I call? Isn't there a center that can evaluate this right? And the truth is that there should be, because you really do need people who have a lot of experience being able to differentiate normal behavior from problem behavior to say what's going on with any individual case. But the reality is it usually takes a combination of the school professionals, pediatricians, some specialty clinics, often with psychological or neuropsychological assessment to help confirm or rule some things out, treatment, prescribing psychiatrists. There's a mixture of different professionals, all of whom you can bring together to help reach that question and get an answer for it. But differentiating it can be tricky. People do have sometimes more severe symptoms and more severe impairment. Those are the easy cases to recognize. You talk to some parents of their children, and they're like, yep, ever since age 3 or 4, he wouldn't stop running. He wouldn't stop climbing the walls. I can't count the number of times he fell off the back of the couch and broke an arm or something like that. And it really becomes very simple. But what becomes more difficult is that these symptoms and behaviors don't always show up that prominently. And it takes a consistent history over time before the pattern becomes really clear. Complicating things even further, if it's a little bit more on the mild side, it might be not until late teenage years, early high school, middle of high school, when demands, academic demands and responsibilities, and even the complexities of social interactions with teenage peers as they emerge into adulthood, those things become more and more difficult. Someone's constraints that they have because of their ADHD symptoms suddenly become more of a problem for them, because maybe they could cope really well when they were 8 or 9, but then you put them in a more challenging environment and it becomes clear that they just can't quite keep up. So you ask about overdiagnosis and misdiagnosis. There's a large controversy about this, and it's an unanswered question in the field. There's no debate. Yes, there are some people who are misdiagnosed, and that inflates our estimates of ADHD. But I would argue that for every person who thinks they have ADHD or is taking a look at some TikTok videos that improperly present the disorder and say, yay, yay, this is me, there's other kids out there that are just not recognized. And it's not uncommon for someone to hit their 20s or 30s and then finally sit back because they've been saying, wait a second, everyone my whole life has told me I'm capable of more than this, that I got better grades when I was younger. Why can't I make this work? Why can't I hold down this job? And they end up finally seeking some help and some answers. And they often feel empowered because they finally get a diagnosis and they undergo some of the treatment options for the first time. And it makes a tremendous difference in their lives.
You know, before we move on to treatment, and that's another big topic, but, you know, one of the other problems I see is a practical one, that not a lot of people have access to proper medical care. In the sense that they may see, again, a paraprofessional, somebody in school and say, oh, this is ADHD. You need to go to your pediatrician and start on Ritalin or something of that nature. I've seen that multiple times. Mm-hmm. So not a lot of people have access to clinical neuropsychology and barely have access to medical care. And do you find people in that regard getting overdiagnosed?
You know, often it's that's certainly a part of the barriers for a proper diagnosis and treatment. Access to insurance has been shown through research studies to be one of the major impediments to proper diagnosis and treatment. But it's also there's all sorts of cultural problems and even ignorance about the disorder. When you have professionals who themselves, despite being educated very well to practice, who don't understand the disorder, you run into some problems and biases kick in. Research has shown very clearly that ADHD is overdiagnosed in racial minorities and underdiagnosed in populations that don't have access to healthcare insurance and things like that. It might be useful to clarify that the field I was originally trained in, back when I used to practice, before I became a full-time neuroscientist, just studying disorders using brain imaging and other technologies, you know, you don't need to be a neuropsychologist to reach a proper diagnosis of ADHD. It is a behaviorally defined disorder. There are no cognitive tests, there are no blood tests or brain scans yet that can definitively say this person has ADHD. It really requires just a very experienced practitioner who knows the disorder, who can help walk families or adult individual patients through the process of understanding their own history and the behaviors and whether or not their impairment levels or symptom severity is enough to really merit the diagnosis.
Mike, did genetics play a role?
Genetics plays a huge role. One thing that people have, for decades, have loved to say incorrectly is that, oh, this isn't a real disorder, or poo-poo, you know, brain stuff, I don't believe it. ADHD is one of the most heritable disorders out there. 70% heritability is the number that people typically say, meaning that you are incredibly likely, if you have a parent with ADHD, to also have ADHD yourself. That's one of the most clear clues that people have had for the last 20 or 30 years that this is, in fact, a brain-based neurobiological disorder for which we're searching for the exact mechanisms so we have targets to treat.
One other thing I want to dispel is the fact that I think that people don't necessarily equate ADHD with being successful in life. I think you and I both know some people who are extremely successful in life, whether it be as physicians, lawyers, or politicians, or whatever, have achieved some of the highest fields and yet suffer from ADHD. So I don't want parents to think, oh, this is some cognitive impairment of some type that renders them not able to learn. Can you embellish on that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I think that's an important take-home message for any of your listeners out there. You know, we can say a lot of very general sweeping things about ADHD. I'll give you a couple of examples that sound really, really bad. You know, if research has shown that if you have ADHD, you're 1.5 times more likely to just hurt yourself in an injury. You're 1.5 to 2.5 times more likely to have problems with hardcore drugs. There was one study in the Scandinavian countries that tracked people over the course of their entire lives. And they took a look to see what their financial net worth was by the time they retired. And they found it was 25% lower if you have ADHD than if you didn't. But the message for people is that these underscore the hazards of untreated illness. But they're also generalized statements about everybody. Every individual has a different combination of strengths and weaknesses. And simply because you have ADHD doesn't mean you can't do everything you want to do in life. But it's going to help if it gets recognized and you find an effective treatment.
Let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about treatment. You know, we've all heard about Ritalin, Adderall, Vyvanse, but I wanted to bring an example to you. Many years ago, and I do mean many years ago, when I was just starting in practice, I sat at Grand Rounds at Hartford Hospital, and there was a presentation by a pediatrician from Connecticut Children's Medical Center on ADHD. And at the end, and back then, everybody, Ritalin was the only drug to use. And at the end of his talk, he said, my son has ADHD, and we opted not to treat him with Ritalin. And instead, we have changed our behavior and our environment to create one where he can be successful. And that really hit me as someone, here's a physician saying, I'm not going to use medication. And I'm sure it was hard for him to do, to change the environment. But can you talk a little bit about that and how it relates to treatment?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So your listeners should know that, you know, when you're a practicing physician, you have suggested professional standards. You have guidelines, and experts in the field meet every decade or so and try to update these guidelines. These are called practice parameters. For ADHD, many people might be very surprised to learn that in this country, those expert guidelines do not recommend medications as the first line treatment for ADHD.
I got to say, I didn't know that, Mike. So let me interrupt and say, I didn't know that. So I don't think many of our listeners know that.
Yeah. Yeah, and many practicing physicians probably don't either. The frontline recommended treatment for children with ADHD is something called behavioral parent training. Now, it's not what you might think from the title. This is not training your parent. This is literally giving some sort of interactive training for parents to educate them as to how to set their interactions with their kids, to set limits with their kids, to structure their environment, to understand better what their kids are thinking and how they process information and how they get motivated and how to engage them to do stuff. It's very much what you described, this environment where you learn how to have a kid thrive, to do the things that is expected of them for school and their social relationships, but to also do it in a way that doesn't lead to constant bickering or conflict in the home or frustration on either the parents or the kid's part. When that doesn't work, or in conjunction with that type of a treatment, is when medications are recommended for kids. However, medications do tend to be one of the top recommendations, along with just cognitive behavioral therapy, for adults who are diagnosed with ADHD.
So this is pretty interesting because, I mean, how many parents can do that? I mean, obviously he had the means and the patience to, you know, go out and change the environment. Do you see many people able to do that in practice?
many people don't know to look for the services. And we even struggle to consistently find referral sources for people who are interested. I'm aware that there's some programs over at the UConn Medical School in Farmington and some other satellite clinics out in Southington and the like. But it becomes difficult to do. What you will find, though, is as many things as I might say about being cautious about what you find on the internet, because they can lead to some bad ideas and misdiagnoses and self-diagnoses, there's a lot of things that most parents who are highly engaged to do what's best for their children can also get a lot of information that puts their feet on the right path to doing exactly what your colleague did when in that presentation years ago.
Wow, and I have to say that that's more than 35 years ago. Let's move on. Let's talk about pharmacologic treatment, and especially in adults. So at what point do you decide with the patient to go forward with a pharmacologic treatment, and what's typically used?
So typically used is a drug like Ritalin, and this is a class of drugs that we collectively refer to as psychostimulants. They have what to many people is a counterintuitive thing. They increase your brain's neurotransmitters and increase your attention and arousal. And people think, well, you've got somebody who's hyperactive. Why would you give them a stimulant? But what it's doing is it's working on certain brain systems that we know are involved with being able to keep your attention or manage your behavior more effectively. So by stimulating those, you actually paradoxically reduce some of the restlessness or hyperactivity while increasing people's ability to attend. Over the past 20 or 30 years, there have been a lot of drugs out there that go by different names. About half of them really are just different versions of those stimulant drugs, either subtly different chemicals or different like sustained release packages where you only have to take one pill in the morning rather than three pills throughout the day. But there are also some different classes of drugs. They work on slightly different brain systems, and they work through different mechanisms. And this is where we start turning our attention as researchers to understanding the causes of the illness. Medications don't work for all people. In general, somewhere between 3 out of 5 to 4 out of 5 people will have a positive beneficial response to medications. So they're frequently tried, because these medications, despite a lot of fears that people have about them, generally have a pretty benign side effect profile. And when people do decide that they don't like the loss of appetite they sometimes have or other minor side effects, it can be an excuse to change. But there's very few life-threatening or medically concerning side effects that come for most people. But when those treatments don't work, there's usually another medication to try, or as what we're seeing over the past 10 or 15 years, research that I'm involved with as well, is that we have lots of experimental treatments that don't involve medicines that people have become very interested in. One of the drawbacks of medications that has been well established is it helps you function better in the moment, but it hasn't really been linked to long-term changes in your life goals or life success or outcome. So they're a management tool that makes you and others feel better, and it helps quite a lot. But there's still something that seems to be missing. We're looking for something that might actually be a treatment that changes the way the brain works consistently. Because one of the things about most of these medications are, they're great when you take them, but they wear off at the end of the day. So you got to take them again the next day. So what a lot of researchers, including myself, are looking for are treatments that you can apply, and then they'll be helpful for a longer period of time. Ways to change the way the brain works and re-sculpt neural networks into a form of functioning that doesn't require these daily maintenance doses of medications.
Can you clarify what you mean by re-sculpt the neural networks? Is it by retraining?
Yeah, this is where... So if you can think about the brain as probably the most complex, intricate machine ever devised, there's so much that we don't know about it. But these brains have multiple systems that work interchangeably. And the way that your brain works for you now is different than the way it worked for you when you were 30 years old, and it's different than the way it worked for you when you were 10 years old. There are normal age-related changes, and like any complex system, it can function in a bunch of different ways. So treatments today tend to look at things like brain stimulation or neurofeedback or cognitive training, where the hope is that you have some target to change the way you consistently use that complex system in a way that might benefit your symptoms and the struggles you might have. I mentioned just two of them there. Cognitive training. We're currently doing a study in teenagers right now that have a brand new approach to just doing brain training exercises 30, 40 minutes a day for a month in the hopes that it can be shown to change systems that are linked to hyperactivity and impulsivity and inattention. We're also about to start a study in ADHD-diagnosed adults that uses brain stimulation on a brand new target that we hope will actually give us the ability to say we can change brain function in ADHD adults so that we can then do a full course of like a month's worth of treatment, like has been approved by the FDA for depression or OCD and similar disorders.
Mike, this is fascinating stuff. I got a quick question here from Patricia. Is ADHD something a child can grow out of?
Yes. So typically what you see is that somewhere around 60 to 80% of ADHD diagnosed children will continue to be either diagnosed as an adult or have ADHD-like symptoms that may not quite be bad enough for most people to say, yeah, the full diagnosis is met. Some kids do outgrow it. The majority of kids do not. There's a lot of questions that have been left about why. We honestly don't understand why symptoms wane. And even more confusingly, over the past decade, we've recognized that a kid who might start out as having lots of hyperactivity and inattention might grow into a kid who just has inattention as a teenager, and then might end up switching again, being more restless and hyperactive and inattentive as an adult. So these presentations also don't just wane, they shift over time in ways that can frustratingly present moving targets for someone to figure out, well, what's really going on with my ADHD? Did it go away? Did it just morph into something else? Hey, what gives? Help me out here.
Mike, this is just fascinating stuff, and I hope in the future we'll continue this conversation. For people who are interested in your clinical trials, either have ADHD, know someone, is the 860-545-7800 number the best number for them to reach out to you at Olin?
Yeah, you know, that's our main number, and we can always leave a voicemail there. But I would also encourage people to just, you know, go to Google. And we have the Olin Neuropsychiatry Research Center and my lab have web pages. It's very easy to find just by Googling me or ADHD research at Hartford Healthcare. Some of our studies that are underway are posted. We're going to be posting the new brain stimulation one within the next couple of weeks because we're about to get that underway and looking for volunteers for that as well. But, yeah, you can always reach out and get to us, and either me or my team will get back to you to answer questions about the research that we're doing.
Mike, thank you for your time today, and thanks for everything you do for our community.
Oh, yeah, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right. In closing, many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we will have a tape program, but I did put together a new intro for everybody with some up-to-date information. I will be on the road, actually traveling to Saudi Arabia to train some physicians to be ringside physicians. So in 2 weeks, I'll be back live with you and bring you up to speed on that experience. If you missed any part of today, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast and download our show at Audacy.com. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.